is beginning to point to the ways in which love depends on wisdom. Wisdom depends on love. This is one way of thinking about the path is investigating dependencies, conditionality, paticca-samuppada, the conditioned nature of phenomena. And love and wisdom have these are interconnected. Wisdom is what makes deep love possible. Thich Nhat Hanh famously said, "Understanding is love's other name." It's a potent line. Understanding is love's other name. And what Tai was pointing to was that really, in a sense, like we must understand someone in order to love them. In other words, love is always a kind of accurate recognition. Love is attuned. Love is attuned. Right? Like lovers want to know why do you love me? Why do you love me? Right? Do you love me for the qualities of my own heart being whatever, or do you love some idealization? And people find it very kind of alienating to be misconstrued, to be loved for what they're not, or something like this, right? Love is attuned. It's attuned. And so, yeah, love depends on wisdom, and the development of wisdom, that takes a lot of love. It takes a lot of love. Insight is a kind of gestational process. It takes 9 months to make a baby, right? But how long to make wisdom? And in that gestational process, love will be involved. And often we just kind of like, we just want to know what to do, like just tell me what to do. Tell me where to focus, tell me what to decide. But wisdom can't be given. It can't be given, really. It has to actually incubate inside of us. It has to gestate. And we ourselves need to be kind of patient with the slow thaw of delusion. Delusion feels like yeah, it just has to thaw, is how it feels. And so we begin with kind of theoretical knowledge, sutta mayapanya, like book knowledge. And that the process by which book knowledge gets under your skin and becomes realization, becomes real, is we have to be patient with that process. We have to be patient with that. And I associate that patience with a kind of soft heartedness. The patience as our own delusion begins to thaw, the patience involved in transmuting kind of like book knowledge into insight, into that which through its very arising brings some measure of freedom. And so Rilke famously, be patient towards all that's unsolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue. Do not seek the answers which cannot be given you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Do not seek the answers because you would not be able to live them. In a way, Suttamayapanya, like book knowledge, like we can't quite live it. We can't quite live it. And so, excuse me, there's a measure of patience, as the kind of, I don't know, it's almost like the photons of the book knowledge kind of like start to penetrate the depths of the mind. And that's that process is sort of what we call practice, right? Like nothing I'll say today is, you know, kind of like at it on the surface, like too complicated or profound or something like that. But the process by which these kind of like ordinary Dharma reflections become real and integrated, that is our practice. And it entails some measure of what I called soft-heartedness, patience, tolerating not knowing. So kindness is important as we begin to mature our understanding. So what is wisdom? I wanted to explore that a little bit. And you know, classically, wisdom is very closely associated with the kind of realization of the Four Noble Truths, that there is dukkha, that there is a cause, causes, that there's an end, and that there's a path leading to the cessation of dukkha. That's you know, I'm not a scholar, but it seems like that's you know, that's often how wisdom is operationalized in the suttas. And I thought it would be useful to look, you know, in a very different direction to illuminate some of this. And so this is an article from I don't know, maybe it's 20 years now, and it was in one is called The Archives of General Psychiatry, very kind of traditional, straight edge, you know, American Medical Association psychiatry journal. And it was about the kind of neurobiology of wisdom. And the author said that wisdom is a unique psychological construct, not just a collection of desirable traits with a unifying label. It's a unique psychological construct, wisdom. Wisdom. And then they go on to identify kind of six components of wisdom that I found kind of compelling. And you'll hear in these components, you know, they're talking about wisdom, but you'll hear just how intimately connected these criteria are with kindness and care, kind of sort of inseparable from them. And so, and I'll share the reference or the article. So the components that that these authors named were the characteristic hallmarks of wisdom: pro-social attitudes and behaviors, value tolerance, self-understanding, dealing effectively with uncertainty and ambiguity, emotional homeostasis, and skill in social decision making. So the six. And you see how much wisdom, is penetrated by love, right? Mindfulness, pro-social values, like, yeah, this is mindfulness is defined by pro-social values of nonviolence, of peace, of non-harm, right? Like this sort of core faculty that we associate with wisdom, sati, mindfulness, is really defined by the absence of antisocial values. Like it's maybe not a pure love kind of thing, but it's like, no, mindfulness is devoid of hate. And what is something that is devoid of hate? It's not exactly love, but it is not far, not far. And then value tolerance. Fundamentalism is the kind of height of arrogance. And I associate fundamentalism and the unwillingness to consider the possibility of being wrong. I associate that with violence. That violence often entails a measure of certainty in the mind. And not knowing is more closely linked to care, to nonviolence. The Shinzen Young teacher said that said in Dharma talk once, like said fundamentalism and mysticism are at the opposite ends of the same spectrum. The Buddhist path is a mystical path. And mystics, whether they're from the Christian tradition or the Buddhist or the Sufi or or Kabbalah or whatever, they don't want to fight. You can be pretty sure if a mystic wants to fight, they're full of shit. If they're like, no, that's not how you do it. Like, wait a second. What have you realized exactly? These are not people who want to fight for views. We know that kind of those moments at the end of sitting or something where it's just like all the energy that is required to fight for views is just drained out of the body mind. And it's not that we have no opinions or no discernment or something like that, but it's just like there's no fight left in us. This is a mystical path. It's a mystical path. And at that end of the spectrum, the mystical end of the spectrum, one's no longer kind of stabilizing one's sense of self through views. A lot of what happens at the fundamentalist end of the spectrum is these views, like are just they become so infused with egoic energy, right? Like, we just see this again and again. It's like, the example I use often is like around COVID and stuff, and like how did 300 million people suddenly develop extremely strong views about a spike glycoprotein and lipid nanoparticles encapsulating messenger RNA that express, it's like, how did this happen? How does that happen? How did these like views get just charged with all this egoic energy? And then you see like the ego literally kills people. And so researcher here at Berkeley, Don Moore, who I actually see in Trader Joe's sometimes. I don't go up to him, but anyway, he said like he's a researcher on overconfidence, and he says like overconfidence is the mother of all psychological biases. We talk about we talk about kind of self-doubt a lot, but overconfidence is a far more pernicious, prevalent source of suffering. And in fact, even in our self-hatred, there's often a measure of overconfidence, Value tolerance, a facet of wisdom. The third, self-understanding. Self-understanding. Wisdom is associated with self-understanding. Larry Rosenberg said, in Buddhism, you don't study Buddhism, you study you. Right? That's a very kind of pith way of putting, like, don't study Buddhism. Study you. We develop all these different capacities for self-understanding, and our self-understanding is limited both by access and by bias. Normally, we just don't have much, if you don't train in it, you actually don't have enough access to the lived experience of being human. It's just layer after layer of concept and preference and reactivity. And so, what is it actually like to be human, to live in the conditions that we call you? That actually requires us to get still and to look. Mindfulness is this kind of self-familiarization. And then we have the kind of ego protective mechanisms that are shielding us from appreciating the complexity of our, psychology. And Dharma helps us with that too. Right. And so, yeah, we study ourself, we study ourself, and we learn. The fourth criteria they describe as acknowledgement and dealing effectively with uncertainty, ambiguity. Now, Nietzsche is, sometimes translated as not certain, uncertainty, right? And so much of our practice is letting the heart acclimatize to a Nietzsche, the kind of startling, unbelievable quality of a Nietzsche, the depth of our default assumption to permanence. And so, impermanent are all compounded things. Understanding this, one knows the highest happiness, peace, right? A lot of what we're doing is opening to change, opening to uncertainty, tolerating uncertainty. Anxiety is sometimes described as the intolerance of uncertainty and the kind of mechanisms of worry that we use to govern uncertainty. A lot of what we're doing with our heart is like, okay, patience, don't know. And an emotional homeostasis, their fifth criterion. Greed, hate, and delusion make us unstable. It's like being bounced around in a pinball machine. Just sort of beaten down by the kind of tides of pleasure and pain, of gain and loss. And so we have to, yeah, just almost like a million times come to the realization that greed, hate, delusion are kind of dead ends. It's hard to believe, you know. One student once said to Ajahn Chah, the forest, Thai forest master, I know clinging causes suffering, you know. I know that. And Ajahn Chah responded, like, well, do you really know that? Investigate you the nature of your allegiance to clinging, was what he was implying. And so wisdom, this facet of emotional homeostasis of I associate it a lot with equanimity, kind of expanding affective tolerance, the kind of false alarms that I was alluding to, the kind of over-interpretation of the signals of unpleasantness in body mind that I was alluding to in the first sit. That is, yeah, that is, leads us into instability. And so to begin to like bear with, to become less intimidated by these signals, pleasure and pain, hope and fear, this leads us into more and more emotional homeostasis. And that doesn't mean a kind of like blunted emotional life. The poignancy of life is still there. The melodrama starts to be drained from that kind of life. And then social decision making, the last of their six. Wisdom is attuned, right? Attuned to the social context. Maybe this is sort of like linked classically to some sampajanya, you know, like clear comprehension, knowing suitability. Often paired sati sampajanya paired with mindfulness, clear comprehension, and that feels right. That feels right. Like as we start to understand ourselves more, we start to actually clarify the inner life of others. We can have more accurate, nuanced, elaborate theory of mind of the other, you know? Like the capacity to understand the inner life, to predict the sort of behavior of of others, that's a kind of excuse me, that's a very critical kind of development in our life, and for wisdom. And as we clarify our own inner landscape, we expand the range of experiences for which we can have empathy. As we in a sense dramatize the poignancy of the human condition, we become more impacted by the inner experience of others. We become sensitive. Krishnamurti called mindfulness like just being sensitive. So those are the six that I wanted to review, and to say that yeah, maybe a definition of wisdom that feels that occurred to me, it feels increasingly important, is we become much better predictors of happiness, suffering, the cessation of suffering. Better predictors, right? It's a little bit of a quirky definition, but it's just reflecting, like, okay, what is wisdom? What is wisdom? And I think we don't usually associate wisdom with predicting things or the future or whatever, but it feels like, okay, prediction is so central in human biology, but also just in the scientific method. That's how we assess, like all of science is based on the falsification or the, tentative confirmation of a prediction. That's what a hypothesis is. This is what I think is going to happen. If you do enough, quantitative research, it's very humbling because it's like you're often wrong. It's just like, no. I made that prediction. I was so confident. I had all this beautiful rationale and elaborate idea, and I cited all the literature from the past. And it's like, and it all points to like, it's going to be A, not B. No. It's B. Okay. Humbling. Falsified. Falsified. It's like, well, this is how so science, kind of how knowledge production emerges through prediction, testing these things. And somehow that's linked to me with happiness. We become better predictors of our own happiness and the happiness of others. Can we make good predictions about our happiness? The Buddha kind of said, like, we're not so good at that. We're not so good. Shantideva said, we hate suffering but love its causes. That's brutal, but it's like so good. We hate suffering but love its causes. That's illuminate something about prediction. We're making bad predictions. And in the scientific world, it's like it's like people are generally not great, what's it called, like affective forecasters. This is a couple researchers. They say many cultures have myths in which people can make their wishes come true. The story of Aladdin and his lamp is best known to readers of the Arabian Nights, and to Disney fans, in Irish legends, it's leprechauns who make wishes come true, whereas in a Chinese fable, it's an obliging dragon that has the head of a camel, the eyes of a hare, the neck of a snake, the claws of an eagle, and the ears of a buffalo. Common to these myths is the notion that if people could make their wishes come true, they would achieve everlasting happiness. Sometimes, however, people are disappointed by the very things they think they want. Research on affective forecasting has shown that people routinely mispredict how much pleasure or displeasure future events will bring, and as a result, sometimes work to bring about events that don't maximize their happiness. Finding ways to increase the accuracy of affective forecasts is a worthy enterprise, though not, we suspect, a particularly easy one. We can predict pleasure quite well. We can forecast what will bring pleasantness or unpleasantness. But we're not maybe such good predictors of satisfaction, of contentment, of peace. And part of Dharma practice is about knowing what we want. Doesn't sound like a very Buddhist thing. What do I want? That's not, sometimes you're wanting whatever is like associated with tanha, with craving or clinging. But I think it's a reasonable question. We are sort of asking it implicitly all the time anyway. What do I want? But in a way, we're now looking for something more like what's worthy of wanting? What's worthy of getting? And the gulf between wanting and getting is often so great. But it doesn't have to be that way. We can want things and get them and not be surprised and disappointed by them because we actually know what we're getting and we know how it will interact with our system, with our goodness, with our defilements, with all of it. We become better predictors of our own happiness. Is this worth doing? Is this project, this whole thing, this whole purchase, this whole whatever, is it worth doing? I think we get better at assessing that and get better at identifying what it is we actually contribute to our welfare. And the uninstructed worldling, to use that kind of weird, dismissive phrase from the suttas, that's how it's translated, uninstructed worldling. That person essentially fails to appreciate the contracts they keep signing about this or that, this pleasure, this project, this possession. And so wisdom, one aspect of wisdom is around prediction itself, becoming more and more skilled at understanding the sources of happiness, the sources of happiness, and beginning to exercise that at the social level. So it's not just wisdom about what we want or what we get when we get what we want. It's about the whole social environment in which we find ourselves. And this is how our love, in a sense, becomes more effective. There's this like deep attunement, kind of like understanding. If we do this, this happens. If we do that, that happens. Like it's actually like very attuned, knowing ourself, knowing our reactions, knowing our goodness, knowing our reactivity, knowing the limits of our equanimity, knowing the limits of the equanimity of the other person or the group, right? And so we become increasingly skilled at navigating the kind of tides of goodness, the tides of defilement, of greed, hate, delusion within the social realm. This is an aspect of wisdom, and it involves, of course, attuning to the causes of suffering, the causes of happiness, of welfare.